done in collaboration with Ruth Dure in Geneva University and Geraldine Servan at CERN. So about gravitational waves from phase transitions. So I will start by giving just a motivation on why to study gravitational waves, and in particular this kind of sources of gravitational waves. And then very generically, I will present you if we have this kind of sources of gravitational waves, what can we expect as the characteristic frequency of those waves, and how the amplitude scales with the parameters, characteristic parameters of the source. Okay, and then I will go more into the details, and I will present you how we modeled analytically this kind of source. So this part will be a bit more technical, and then I will present the final results for the gravitational wave spectra. There has been previous analysis on this idea. So the first analysis were in the early 90s. Okay, these papers used numerical simulations to nucleate the bubbles of the false vacuum and collide them, and they had some results. And then in the beginning of 2000, it was also proposed that turbulence might generate gravitational waves, as we will see. And then the issue of turbulence has been reanalyzed also recently. Okay, so why consider a primordial source of gravitational waves? Okay, so first of all, what are gravitational waves in the cosmological context? So they are just tensor perturbations of the Friedmann metric. Okay, tensor, so that they satisfy the condition of being without divergence and without trace. Okay, and then if you insert this perturbed metric into Einstein equation, then you end up with a wave equation for the tensor perturbation, so for the gravitational wave. You see it's just a wave equation plus a damping term, which is there because the universe is expanding. This assumes radiation domination, okay? And then the source, Pij, is the anisotropic stress, so that part of the energy momentum tensor that couples to the tensor mode, which is also then traceless and divergenceless. Okay, and so whenever we need to generate gravitational waves, what we need to look for is the anisotropic stress, that's the source, into a fluid, for example. Okay, the nice thing about gravitational waves, and in particular about primordial sources, that in the context of this linearized theory, once the gravitational waves are emitted, then they propagate without interaction with the rest of the cosmic fluid, okay? So that means that if we have a source of gravitational waves early on in the universe and we are able to detect the gravitational waves today, those are really a direct probe of the physical process that produced them in the early universe, just as it happens for the CMB. So another way to rephrase this is to say that gravitons are decoupled for temperature which are lower than the mass of Planck, than the Planck temperature. Okay, of course, this is the reason why it is so difficult to detect gravitational waves, because they don't interact much. Anyways, but suppose that we are able to see this stochastic background, etc. How to characterize it? Then, so whenever we have a primordial source, this generates a stochastic background of gravitational waves, okay? The example you all have in mind is the stochastic background coming from inflation. And so stochastic background, assumed that it has a Gaussian distribution, etc., is completely determined by its power spectrum. And in particular, so the quantity I will be interested in determining during this talk is the gravitational wave energy density per logarithmic unit of frequency normalized to the critical energy density today. Okay, so this is the quantity, that's the spectrum of the gravitational waves that I'm going to try to determine in the talk. So, which is the characteristic frequency that we can expect from a mechanism of generation of gravitational waves in the early universe? So let's suppose that we have this process that generates gravitational waves at a given time, eta star. And let's suppose that we are in radiation, in the radiation-dominated era, and that we are in a phase of standard Friedmann expansion. Okay, so I'm not considering inflation by now. Then, by causality, the characteristic frequency of the gravitational waves which are produced by this mechanism has to be larger or equal than the Hubble scale at that particular moment of generation. Okay, simply by causality. So this defines what can be thought of as a frequency window from coming from a cosmological source. So if we sort of consider a cosmological source acting from very early on up to equality, for example, okay, we can expect frequencies from extremely low ones corresponding to the horizon at the moment of equality up to very, very high ones if we consider the energy scale of inflation. Okay, so 10 to the minus 15 Hertz up to 1 gigahertz. So basically, there is anything is possible. But still, of course, one needs to find a possible source within this huge amount of time that we have at our disposal. And in particular, now, if you consider the phase when the universe had a temperature of 100 GeV, corresponding to the electric phase transition, then by this rule here, the characteristic frequency of the gravitational waves have to be larger or equal than 10 to the minus 5 Hertz. Okay, and now the thing starts to be very interesting because if you consider the space interferometer LISA, okay, it has a frequency range in which it is able to detect, which is quite low, at low frequency, so from 10 to the minus 4 Hertz up to 1 Hertz. Okay, so you see that from the electric phase transition, we can have something that could be in the correct range of detection of LISA. And in particular, the sensitivity of LISA is omega g of the order of 10 to the minus 12, okay, the maximum sensitivity, it is reached at about 1 millihertz of frequency. Okay, so the thing is interesting, we have still to see how can a gravitational wave be generated by a phase transition? Okay, so first of all, the phase transition has to be first order in order to for gravitational waves to be generated. So I'm considering some kind of extension of the standard model in which the electric phase transition is first order. And then, so a first order phase transition proceeds through the nucleation of bubble of the false vacuum. Then this bubble expands, and towards the end of the phase transition, they collide because they need to convert the entire universe to the broken phase. Okay, so bubbles by itself have spherical symmetry, so they do not generate gravitational waves, but towards the end of the phase transition, bubbles collide, as it is showed in this cartoon. Collision breaks spherical symmetry, generates a non-zero anisotropic stress, and so generates gravitational waves background. Okay, on top of that, the collision of the bubbles causes an injection of energy in the cosmological fluid. And the cosmological fluid is characterized by an extremely low viscosity, okay, very high Reynolds number, so any injection of energy will generate turbulent motions. Turbulent motions that are just an anisotropic distribution of a velocity field, okay, so they also possess an anisotropic stress, and so they also are an independent source of gravitational waves. And then, at last, we have that since those turbulent motions arise in a fluid which is completely ionized, so that's the universe very early on, then these generate currents and so magnetic fields. And the magnetic fields, they also possess an anisotropic stress and they give rise to gravitational waves. Okay, so we have at the first order phase transition three independent processes that can lead to a stochastic background of gravitational waves. So they have all a characteristic scale, a common characteristic scale, which is the size of the bubble when we have the collision. Okay, because they are all generated by this initial process of collision of the bubbles. So, If we consider, so what is this size? Okay, if we consider a parameter beta minus 1, which determines the duration of the phase transition, this has to be, this is normally of the order of 10 to the minus 2 times the Hubble time, okay, because the phase transition has to happen very quickly, or at least in fraction of the Hubble time, in order, otherwise we cannot convert the entire universe to the broken phase by collision. Okay, so this is, let's say, a characteristic duration of the phase transition. The speed of the bubble walls is some number, smaller or bigger than one, than the speed of light. And then this tells us that the size of the bubble towards the end of the phase transition when they collide is about just VB times beta minus 1. The characteristic frequency of the gravitational waves, which are emitted by the three processes, is exactly connected to the size of the bubble at collision. Okay, so the characteristic frequency is 1 over r. And if we rewrite it in this way, okay, you see then beta over h is of the order of 100. VB is something of the order 1. If we normalize it to a temperature when the universe had a temperature 100 GeV, you see that we fall exactly in the millihertz range. So exactly there where LISA has its largest sensitivity. Okay, so this means that having gravitational waves produced from a first order phase transition at around 100 GeV is very promising for detection. Okay, so yet one needs to get the correct amplitude. Okay, correct frequency is not enough. You also need to get something that has an amplitude above the lowest sensitivity of the interferometer LISA. So now I will try to tell you how a generic spectrum of gravitational waves scales with the characteristic quantities of the source, like its duration and its energy density. Okay, for a source which is radiation-like, that evolves like radiation. So for this, I need to just give a few definitions. Let's start by considering the bubbles, okay? The broken phase bubbles, which are nucleated during the phase transition. So the phase transition, since we are in a universe, does not happen in vacuum. It happens in a thermal bath. And so this means that the nucleation of bubble will be driven by the dynamic of the scalar field, which is determining the phase transition. But once the bubble are nucleated, and above all towards the end, their evolution can be described just as an hydrodynamic process. Okay, so basically those bubbles are nothing else but some given fluid velocity configurations which have a spherical symmetry. Okay? And so the energy momentum tensor, which is described in the bubble, is just the energy momentum tensor of a relativistic fluid. Okay, rho plus p is the enthalpy density for third rho. Gamma is the gamma factor, and this velocity, which is appearing here, is just the velocity profile that is describing the bubble. Okay, so from this form of the energy momentum tensor, we can define, just by convenience, a parameter that quantifies the amount of kinetic energy which is given by a bubble normalized to the radiation energy density in the universe. Okay, so from the form of the energy momentum tensor, it just keeps this parameter just keeps this simple form. Okay, this is just the definition. So this will tell you how much energy we have at disposal in our source to generate gravitational waves. So exactly the same can be done for the turbulence. Okay, in this case, once again, the energy momentum tensor describing the turbulence is just the energy momentum tensor of a fluid. Okay, oh, here maybe, so I'm dropping, of course, I'm considering only the spatial part, I'm dropping the trace, etc., because this is the part of the energy momentum tensor that couples to the tensor mode. Okay? So it's a simplified way of writing it down. In the case of turbulence, now Vi is no longer the velocity profile in the bubble, but it is just the velocity distribution of the turbulent motions. Okay, rho plus p is still relativistic enthalpy. And then, since, as we will see later on, we use a model of turbulence, which is Kolmogorov-like, and so it is not adapted to describe relativistic motions, okay, for the turbulence, we omit the factor gamma, and we set an upper bound to the velocity field, which corresponds to velocities of the order of the sound speed. Okay, so in this case, the equivalent of that parameter, okay, the kinetic energy in the turbulence normalized to the radiation energy density in the universe, just takes this form here, where V squared, the kinetic energy, then it's smaller or equal than 1/3 corresponding to the sound speed in a relativistic fluid. Okay, and for magnetic fields, exactly the same can be done, okay, we have a quite similar energy momentum tensor now. The vector which is describing the source, of course, is the magnetic field, no longer a velocity, and then this is the way we define this, this parameter. Okay.
And so is it known that robustly the electric phase transition is first order?
No, 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 absolutely not. Oh. So in the context of the standard model, it is for sure second order, or even a first order. So here I am invoking some kind of extension.
So in MSSM, the
yeah, the MSSM and MSSM or something like that. There are models. It depends. You change a bit the potential and you might get the first order phase transition. So in cosmology, it is quite justified to do so because you know that with the standard model, we cannot explain many things. Baryon asymmetry, neutrino masses, etc. So you need to invoke some kind of extension. This analysis that I am presenting here is completely independent, so it does not assume a given particle physics model. Okay, I'm just parameterizing to these two quantities, the energy density in the bubble walls and the duration of the phase transition, and I'm just letting them as free parameters.
But out of curiosity, how generic is it that in these extensions that it's going to be first order, or does it require something?
It does require. It depends on your model. It's not that just whatever extension we give your first order sensation. It depends on the x potential that you want to analyze.
So in first of all, in first order, first transition, you have the creation of these bubbles.
Yes.
In second order, what happens?
You know? No, everything is continuous. There is so the potential varies with temperature without generating this potential barrier and without nucleation of bubble. Okay.
Sorry, how do you estimate the energy density in bubble wall?
You will see later on. So we have a given profile for this velocity. I will present you the by now, those are just definitions. Okay, so now, given those definitions, what is, can we predict a general scaling for the gravitational wave spectrum? Depending on those parameters. The answer is yes. If we start by Einstein equations, okay, we rewrite them in this way. So H is the tensor perturbation. Beta, as I told you before, is the beta minus one is the characteristic time of evolution of the source, okay? So the left-hand side is something of the order of beta squared times H. Right-hand side is given by the energy momentum tensor of the source, the particular one we are considering, okay, one of the three, collision of bubbles, turbulence, or magnetic field. Then what we need to estimate, this is just a very rough order of magnitude estimate, okay, to show you the scalings. What we need to estimate is the energy density in gravitational waves, which is given by the squared of the time derivative of the tensor perturbation, okay. And then from this equation here, we can have this formula very simply. The energy momentum tensor, as I showed you a minute ago, is just something which is rho radiation times this dimensional parameter that tell us the amount of energy which is present in the source. And then if we substitute these two quantities in here, That's the final formula we get. Okay, so omega gravitational waves is something of the order of omega radiation today. This is just a normalization factor. Okay, and then we have that this scales like the square of the ratio between the duration of the source, okay, and the Hubble time, and then the square of the total energy which is available in the source. Okay, this scaling is very, very general. It can be simply derived by this very simple rewriting of the Einstein equation, let's say. Okay, so now can we get the correct amplitude? We saw that we got the correct frequency for Lisa. Can we get the correct amplitude? And omega radiation is a number of the order of 10 to the minus 5. This thing here is a number of the order of 10 to the minus 4. As I told you, the phase transition happens much faster than one Hubble time. Okay, so this is normally of the order of 100. Sorry, of 10 to the minus 2, I mean, so this is 10 to the minus 4. And this quantity here, we can say in a optimistic situation, can be of the order of 10 to the minus 2. So that the energy density contained in the source is about 0.1 of the radiation energy density in the universe. Okay, and so you see, if we add up everything, we have an omega gravitational waves of the order of 10 to the minus 11. Okay, which is right above the sensitivity of Lisa. Now, here this about equal sign can contain a numerical factor which can be sensitively smaller than one. Okay, but the point is that at least we are not like in inflation, three or four order of magnitude down with respect to the Lisa sensitivity. We have something that is quite promising.
You said this on the previous transparency, but maybe you can. So how do you know how fast the first of the phase transition occur, and in particular, how fast it compared to the Hubble time?
Yeah, so
where does the estimate come from?
Yeah, it depends on the, of course, on the model of the phase transition, so on your action, basically. From the action, you can calculate the beta parameter.
How do I do it? Are you going to say this? Or?
Sorry?
How do I do it? Suppose I have, it's a first order phase transition.
Yeah, maybe I can tell you later. There okay. are a few formulas, yeah. So beta is basically just the time derivative of the action, etc. So everything is determined once you have your action.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the reason why, for what we are interested in now, the reason why this is of the order of 10 to the minus 2 is because you need to do it quick enough, okay, the phase transition. Otherwise, the universe expands,
and you cannot collide all the bubble and convert all the universe to the broken phase.
You see?
The transition must be fast enough.
Fast enough.
To the expansion.
Exactly. So
okay, I see.
For now, I'm saying fast enough. I am assuming that it is 10 to the minus 2. Okay. It could be 0.1, it could be 10 to the minus 3. Mm-hmm. It depends on the details of the action.
Right.
Okay, so. Then now we saw we have sort of the characteristic, sort of the correct frequency, sort of the correct amplitude. So now I'm going into the details of our model. Okay, how did we actually model those sources and evaluate it analytically the gravitational wave spectra which are generated? Okay, so as we saw in the first slide, what we want to calculate is the gravitational wave energy density per logarithmic unit of frequency, okay, which is just something like k cube, which is the phase space, rho c is the energy density, critical energy density in the universe, h square dot is the power spectrum of the gravitational wave energy density, okay. Hij is just the tensor perturbation. As yes, here we have a delta, like always in cosmological sources, because of homogeneity and isotropy. Okay, this is just the power spectrum. I'm assuming a Gaussian distribution, etc. So the tensor perturbation comes from the solution of the wave equation I showed you in the first slide. Okay, so it's nothing else but the integral from a initial time of action of the source up to a generic time of the anisotropic stress, which is the source, times the Green function coming from the wave equation. So now you see that if we want to evaluate this and then this, what we need to know is the power spectrum of the anisotropic stress. Okay. The anisotropic stress is just given by some projector that extracts from the energy momentum tensor the part that couples to the tensor mode. Okay, so what we need to find is the power spectrum of T. And T, the energy momentum tensor in K-space, is just given by the convolution of the vector field, which is described in our source. So either the velocity profile, which is described in the bubble, or the magnetic field, etc. Okay, it's just this convolution. So if you now go backwards, you see that what we need in order to evaluate this quantity, okay, is the four-point correlation function of our vector field. Now, of course, analytically, we cannot evaluate a four-point correlation function. So what we do is that we assume some form of Gaussianity. So we assume that Vi is Gaussianly distributed so that we can use Wick theorem to reduce the four-point correlation function into products of the power spectrum. And so in the end, in order to know the power spectrum of the gravitational waves, what we need to know is the power spectrum of the source. Very simple.
Slide. So can I ask you, so at these frequencies, right, so aren't there constraints on how much gravity waves there are based on binary pulsar?
Yes, yes. So binary pulsars is at a frequency which is lower, okay, the constraint of binary pulsars. But there are constraints given by nucleosynthesis. So the nucleosynthesis bound on the gravitational waves is a bound which is integrated on frequency, so it applies
sure.
to any.
No, but possible. Even for, okay, so, but you have a spectrum nevertheless, so you may.
Yeah.
So you're still going to predict some.
Exactly. So you will see the spectrum in a minute, uh-huh. yeah. But the point is that this is way down any possible bound, okay, because Lisa sensitivity is much below. For example, the bound from nucleosynthesis is only the jitter to the minus pi.
Right.
Okay, here we are talking about the 10 to the minus 12. All right. Also, the pulsars is something comparable, maybe it goes to 10 to the minus 6, if I remember correctly. But you know, all those bounds are way older than magnitude higher. Okay, so now the point is that I will tell you how we model the power spectrum of our source. So let's start with bubble walls, okay? Maybe answer the question that was asked before. Okay, so as I told you before, we model the bubble, the evolution of the bubble simply as an hydrodynamic process. Okay, so we will have, this is the physics, let's say, of combustion. Okay, we will have a combustion front, which is the bubble wall where the phase transition is taking place. Okay, on one side, we still have the symmetric phase in which there is still the presence of a vacuum energy density, okay? Then here, the phase transition is taking place. On the other side, so inside the bubble, we have the broken phase in which the entire vacuum energy is converted to radiation energy density. Okay, and the way to describe the evolution of this discontinuity, this combustion front, it's in principle quite simple in the sense that one just needs to impose conservation of energy and momentum across the discontinuity. And this has been done already many years ago. For example, you can find it in Landau-Lifshitz or in this paper by Steinhardt, etc. And so this combustion front, this bubble wall, if you want, can evolve in two ways. One is by detonations. If we take the reference frame of the bubble wall, then we will have, of course, the bubble wall is moving outwards, the bubble is expanding, then the symmetric phase is going inwards and the broken phase is going outwards, okay? So, if this velocity here is supersonic,
then we say that we have a detonation. Okay? In this case, then, the symmetric phase is at rest. So outside here, everything is at rest. This is the bubble wall. Okay, here we have a refraction wave because this thing is supersonic. So here we have a refraction wave that brings the fluid to rest within the center of nucleation. Okay, and the profile has been demonstrated in this paper to be a shell of non-zero velocity. Okay, and within here instead the velocity is already zero, and here the velocity is growing. In deflagration, instead, V1 is subsonic. So in this case, the fluid in the symmetric phase is pushed by the bubble because the velocity is subsonic. Okay, so this now corresponds to the bubble wall. Here we have the generation of a shock wave. So the fluid in the symmetric phase is pushed. Here the velocity is growing, and here this is the boundary of the shock wave in which the velocity is supersonic. Okay, so this is the way we modeled our bubbles. The dependence of the velocity on the distance from the nucleation center is a bit complicated. So in order to proceed analytically, we need to simplify it. We needed to simplify it. So what we assumed for the velocity profile described in the bubble as a function of space and time is just that the velocity is growing linearly with the distance from the nucleation center. Okay. It's not exactly the case, but it is almost the case. So the velocity, total velocity profile will be given by this formula within the shell of non-zero velocity, and it is zero everywhere else. Okay, so now why all that for describing the velocity profile? Because if we want to know the power spectrum of the source, we need to know the two-point correlation function. Okay, the power spectrum is the Fourier transform of the two-point correlation function. I remind you that Vi then is a stochastic variable because the nucleation point is a random variable. Okay. So what can we say when we have this profile? What can we say about the two-point correlation function? So we have that the velocity field in a point x will be correlated with the velocity field in a point y only if these three conditions are met. So first of all, the distance between x and y must be smaller than the diameter of a bubble. Otherwise, they are in different bubbles and then they are uncorrelated. So this is zero. So x and y must be in the same bubble, and they must be in that region of the bubble in which the velocity is non-zero. Otherwise, this two-point correlation function is zero just because the velocity is zero. Okay, so the three conditions here translate into the fact that the nucleation center of the bubble must be within a volume which is given by the intersection of two shells which have the same dimension of the bubbles but which are centered in x and y, in the points in which we are evaluating the correlation function. Okay. Now, as always in cosmology, we invoke some kind of ergodicity, okay, and we say, okay, then the two-point correlation function is nothing else but the mean over all the possible nucleation center position over this intersection volume of the velocity distribution of our velocity field times the probability that there is actually a nucleation center in this volume. Okay, so now you see it is a very well-defined problem. One just has to evaluate this integral for different configuration of the volume. So if you are able to do so, then we can take the Fourier transform and calculate the power spectrum. Okay, so we have done. So this is the formula we get for the power spectrum. Delta function is there because of homogeneity and isotropy of the source. Then we have v squared, so the velocity, the squared of the velocity at the boundary of the bubble. We have the size of the bubble cube that keeps the correct dimension. We have this factor here, which is the probability that a point is in the broken phase at a given time, okay, connected to the probability of finding a nucleation rate in that particular volume. So it's 1 minus the exponential of the nucleation rate. And then there is this tensorial structure here. Okay, so we have the two functions, A and B, function of K, which give us actually the power spectrum. Okay, so these are the form of the two functions A and B that we found doing the Fourier transform numerically. Okay, so there is something important to say here is that as we have seen, the correlation function is a function with compact support, which means that it is zero, okay, outside a separation between X and Y, which is for a separation between X and Y, which is larger than the diameter of the bulb. Okay, so the Fourier transform of a function with compact support must be analytic. So now if you consider analyticity of this quantity here, well, you see that the function A, for K goes to zero, can be flat, okay, no problem. But the function B, because of the presence of those unitary vectors here, must go at least as K squared. Okay, so this is a consistency check, and that's exactly what we find. Then something else that can be said is that since the correlation function is going to zero at this characteristic scale here, corresponding to the radius of the bubbles, then this scale will show up in the power spectrum, and you see it is about the scale at which we have this changing in behaviors of the function A and B, which is about P over R. At scales which are much smaller than the peak, both functions decrease in the same way as k to the minus 4. Okay, so now we do have the power spectrum, and we put it into this machinery here, and we can find the power spectrum of the gravitational waves. Okay, what about turbulence and magnetic field? In this case, the situation is much simpler, because this is a problem that has been already studied, for example, by Kolmogorov many years ago. Okay, so in that case, we just take known spectra. Just let me tell you a little bit the details. So once again, we have a characteristic correlation scale, which is the diameter of the bubble. So once again, in this case, sorry, the diameter of the bubble that corresponds to the scale of injection of energy into the fluid, so the scale at which the turbulence first develops. Okay, so we expect in the power spectrum a peak at about a scale pi over r. There is a difference with respect to the bubble case in the sense that for incompressible turbulence and also for magnetic field, the vector field has to be divergenceless. And so the two functions here, A and B, those two there are reduced to a simple, just one function, and we have this projector here, which is there to keep the divergence less of the entire quantity. Okay, and if we now apply again this reasoning for the analyticity, we can predict that the power spectrum must go as k to the squared for very low k, okay, because of the same reasoning as before. So that's the spectrum that we consider, okay, at a very low scale, very large scales, we have a k squared increase. Then we have this peak here that appears at about the frequency pi over r. And then we have a small scale behavior that is power laws, which are determined for the turbulence we use Kolmogorov theory, so minus 11/3 for the magnetic field, the Hiroshnikov-Kreitmann, which is minus 7 halves. Okay. So now, from both the power spectrum, it is quite logical that in the gravitational wave power spectra, we will have a peak at about the same scale. So this is what I was telling you before, that the frequency is 1 over r and corresponds to the millihertz. Okay, one last general consideration about those power spectra. Okay, the large scale part of the gravitational wave power spectrum always increase like k cubed. And this is simply connected to the fact that we are considering causal sources. Okay, so a generic causal power spectrum, as we saw a minute ago, is given in principle by two different power laws, okay, a large scale power law N, a small scale power law M, and it changes shape at about pi over r. Okay, so what is the anisotropic stress power spectrum that we can expect from this power spectrum here of the source? The anisotropic stress is just given by the convolution of the power spectrum. And if one consider at very large scales, and if the power, the spectral indices satisfy these conditions here, okay, which are just basically finiteness of the energy density, so they are always satisfied in our case, then you see that pi is actually a constant for large scales, for k that goes to zero. Okay, so we have white noise spectrum for the anisotropic stress. Of course, this is quite obvious because since we have this correlation scale, 1 over r, then it means that on scales larger than that, the signal adds up randomly, and so we will get a white noise. Okay, so now, if you consider this formula here that I showed you before, see if this is white noise, because we multiply, you have this k cube factor given by the phase space, then we must always have a k cube increase for the gravitational wave energy density. So it's very simple. And this is a double check. When we do our numerics, we need to find this kind of behavior at large scales. Okay, so now the results. So this is what we get from the gravitational wave from bubbles. So you recognize here the scaling that I showed you before, okay, squared of the ratio between the duration of the source and the bubble time, squared of the total energy density present in the source. The parameter omega rad, here you see that we have quite a small numerical factor appearing. Okay, and then we have a given spectral shape, which is showed in this picture. So you see the k cubed increase, you see the peak at about 1 over r, or pi over r, let's say, and then we have a given small scale decrease, which depends on the characteristic of the source. Okay, in this case, we get minus 1.8 for the slope here. So now, what is the amplitude here? That's the important question for Lisa. Here you have a plot of how the amplitude at the peak behaves with the velocity of the bubble wall. Okay, and then we see that we can get just about the sensitivity of Lisa, okay? Either if the bubble wall has a sufficiently high speed, okay, 0.5, and then we can allow the bit average parameter of the order of 100. On the other hand, if we go a bit down with the velocity of the bubbles, then we must go down also with the parameter bit average. So the phase transition must last a bit longer, okay? For us, these are really independent parameters just you know, to evaluate, to adjust, to have the correct sensitivity. Okay, so it is, let's say, minimal for detection in this case. Okay, and now let me tell you some very preliminary results of the turbulent source. Okay, in this case, we are considering the possibility, which is very interesting, that the turbulence lasts for longer than just an Hubble time. And the reason is that once you have this injection of energy in the primordial fluid, okay, the viscosity of the primordial fluid is extremely low, and it won't increase enough to dissipate the turbulent motion up to temperature of 1 MeV. So in principle, we can have a presence of turbulent motion on very small scales during several Hubble times. This is extremely important because you get rid of this factor here, right? And so you can increase your amplitude. And in fact, the result that we have, okay, is now this one. So you see the scaling is the same, but that fraction there now is something of the order one. Okay, and then we still have the k cubed increase due to causality, and then a small scale increase that apparently goes like k to the minus 5/3. This is the preliminary spectrum that we have. And here then, because we don't have that factor, we can increase the omega gravitational waves. So for most optimistic energy conditions, so the energy density in the turbulence corresponds to motions that are of the order of the sound speed. Okay, so this parameter is 2.9. Then we can get an omega gravitational waves of the order of 10 to the minus 10. And in this case, it means that Lisa can see the bump. Okay. Okay, so let me conclude. So we have analyzed these three sources of, well, magnetic field is exactly the same thing as of the turbulence. The only thing that changes is this slope here. It might get, I don't know now if it is more steep or less. The analysis will have to say that. Anyway, so we have analyzed gravitational waves from these three sources. We have seen two extremely important general characteristics. The spectra have to rise like k cubed, just because this, our sources are causal, and they peak at a frequency of about 1/r, corresponding to the size of the bubbles. Okay, so the characteristic size of the source. This is of the order 1 mHz for the first order electric phase transition, so good for detection with this. Gravitational waves from bubbles is limiting observable. If the bubble wall is bubble wall velocity is sufficiently high, so of the order of 1/2 the speed of light, or if the phase transition lasts a bit longer than what is usually assumed for this parameter beta over h. The gravitational waves from turbulence are a bit more promising for detection if we consider motions of the order of the speed of sound. Okay, so with respect to previous analysis in which this analytic estimate improves things. So first of all, we were able to extend, as I showed you, our analysis to the deflagration case. Okay, because in the paper that that analyzed the problem during during numerical simulation of the nucleation of bubble and the collision, they just treated the case of thin wall approximation. It means that the bubble is just considering as a discontinuity, okay, and the energy density is non-zero only really near the wall. And this applies only for very strongly first order phase transition, and when the bubble then expands as detonation. Instead, if the phase transition is not strongly first order, okay, we can still have the nucleation of bubbles, but the bubble wall proceeds slowly, and slowly corresponds to deflagration. Okay, so this is sort of a more realistic case for a first order phase transition in the universe. Okay, then with the analytic, our analytic method allow to find quite robust prediction for the high and low frequency slopes of the gravitational wave spectrum, and not just for the peak amplitude. And then the other important point that we saw is that the peak frequency is connected to the size of the bubbles. Okay, previously in the previous analysis, it was claimed that it was connected to the duration of the phase transition. The important point here is there is a velocity factor between the two, okay? And so if the bubble expands slower, like in deflagration, then it means that we shift the peak to higher frequency, which is better for detection for this. Okay, that's all.
To Alex's question, so I mean, presumably people have come up with explicit models where you have a phase or a first order phase.
Yes.
So in principle, then all your parameters are
computed. There are analysis of that. Yes, sorry. There was a paper recently in May, okay, where they assume a particular model, I think, in which in the X potential you have a self-interaction of the sixth order or something like that, and then they fix the parameter and they find that in that case, which is limiting for the detection, as we found here.
Okay. So they get values of beta or whatever.
Yes, yes, everything is fixed. Okay, the thing which is just difficult to, okay, it's not enough like to have a particle physics model, then you must be able to solve the problem of the evolution of the bubbles. Okay, which is not normally a non-trivial problem, above all in the deflagration case, because the bubble wall is interacting with the thermal bath, etc. So it is not, so for example, this paper I'm talking about now, I don't remember the authors, but they have a given model to evolve the bubble wall, and so within their model, they give prediction for detection. Okay, but it's not a simple problem.
So I have two questions. One, the first one is, presuming you saw the signal, is there nothing else at this particular characteristic frequency and that you would see with Lisa that would be confused with it? I mean, would you know if you, yeah. Would Lisa know that it saw the electrowave
spectrum? Yeah. So there is a stochastic background from binaries, stragalactic binaries, which is sort of going down exactly at around the millihertz. So if we are able to see, for example, to get a prediction for 5 or 10 millihertz, then it's better because we are outside this background from boundaries.
Okay, maybe I have three questions actually. Because the second question is, if you did see this, would you be able to, based on the what you'd learned about the electric phase transition, could you use this to find out? I mean. People want to use electrowave phase transition, as you said, for like baryogenesis.
Yes.
So could you find out from these gravity waves whether that is the place where baryogenesis happened?
Well,
I'm just sort of like dream scenario.
The point is, okay, if you just see the peak,
you don't learn anything.
The two parameters that you will be able to determine is the duration and the energy density. In the bubbles. Whether this gives you something more, like the form of the potential or the possibility of, I'm not sure. But for sure, this tells you that the electric phase transition is first order.
Sure, right, which is an important one. Okay, so that leads to my third question, which is even in the first order case, how confident are you that these perfectly spherically symmetric bubbles, is that pretty robust, or is there a possibility that those bubbles will just depart from purely?
Yeah, so, okay, the static configuration is spherical. So if they sort of deviate from that, then friction, etc., they keep them spherical. Okay. So that is quite robust. If they were not spherical, that would be even better, because then single bubble could generate gravitational waves. The fact that they are spherical is a sort of a conservative assumption.
And curiosity. Is there someone using numerical technique to solve the problem of the evolution of the bubbles?
Yes, yes, yes. There are papers on this. Yes. So there is this one that I mentioned. Too bad that I don't remember you. But I can tell you, I'll show you later. So this one, for example, then there are studies for the QCD phase transition by Lane, for example, in which they really evolve numerically the bubbles. And actually our form for the bubble, which assume the fact that the bubble have reached a steady state in expansion, etc., all that is sort of justified by the results of those accurate numerical simulations.
So did you get another set of these, the QCD phase transition?
Yes, yes. So at temperature, at lower temperature, then you have the QCD phase transition. Uh-huh. But it is no interest of considering it because the frequency is outside the range of detection for these. Okay. So that's why I don't care.
Okay, so that's 7.3.